Welcome to the fourth episode of Reverse Swept Radio. This is Andy Ryan.
And on this side of the safer, it's Toby Chad.
And this week's podcast is being done in memory of Xavier Doherty's beautiful but brief test career.
Long may he rest in peace.
Right, to business. I don't think we could ever have imagined 2 weeks ago we'd have found ourselves quite in this position, gloating over, well, not gloating, politely reminiscing over an innings victory for England in Adelaide. We're going to start by taking some cheap shots at Ricky Ponting, aren't we?
We are, and just quite what's happened to Ricky, quite why he seems to have gone so awry. I mean 7-2 fields are all very well when you've got Glenn McGrath putting things on a penny outside off stump, but he certainly doesn't seem to have helped his slightly ailing batting attack.
The idea here seems to be that he's not got very good bowlers, so he'll seem to respond with very, very crazy captaincy, as if that will take wickets. The issue being that mad, bold captaincy needs very good bowlers to support it. And I think the image of Siddle in particular bowling half length to Peterson will sort of stick in the memory. It was a massacre.
I think one of the... I hate to talk about the English cricket side teaching the Australians lessons, but one of the things that Strauss has pulled off so consistently well is a kind of simplicity in his plans that he's... Well, it's not always simple. He's known when to attack. He's known when to do crazy, but he's also known when to have sessions where he just sits back and he defends and he waits. You know, he frustrates batsmen. And I just don't think that's been the case with Ponting.
I suppose the only thing Ponting could perhaps say in his defence is that Strauss has had the luxury of an attack that, frankly, has got on with it and done its job. I mean, my feeling about Ponting is that he's a great of the game, and perhaps. He's used to playing with greats, and you just wonder whether he doesn't occasionally get into this dressing room, look around himself, and feel slightly appalled.
Well, I do wonder as well, talking of greats, whether because his own batting has been so poor, he's used to being a game-changing batsman and going out there and making innings which change the face of the game. Because he's not doing that, in a sense, he has to make up for it with his captaincy, and that's actually having quite a knock-on effect.
Yeah, because he leads as a batsman, doesn't he? He leads as a batsman.
He's not a tactician, and he never has been. He's never been a Mike Brilley or something.
Well, you're now in a situation where, frankly, if he wasn't captain, the runs he's scoring would make him a questionable selection.
Yeah, absolutely. And the runs he's been scoring for the last...
I mean, I thought the most tragic thing was he comes out the night before the fourth day of the test and says, how we bat over the next 2 days will show what we're made of. He then goes in, looks all at sea against Swan, gets out cheaply, and you think, well, it's not quite sort of the Aussie spirit. But perhaps from one legend to another, this legend being a chain-smoking one who now resides in the commentary box.
And plays a lot of poker.
Quite successfully.
I wonder whether Australia are playing poker. That's a smooth transition, isn't it? Are playing poker a bit here. Because
playing poker with the Ashes.
I'm probably going to fail, I think, because I think you're slightly more of a fan of this idea of Shane Warne making a majestic return than I am.
Well, I think, firstly, what we should say in defence, that at the moment, this is pretty much... This could, to all intents and purposes, just be the media's idea. We don't really know if Ricky Ponting... I personally think it would be... As an England, in terms of England's prospects of winning, I would be concerned about seeing Shane Warne in the starting lineup. I think he's that sort of a player that I just don't want to see in that Australian 11 as an Englishman.
Despite the fact that he's only playing, the only cricket he's played recently has been in the IPL.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we put this down to almost a sort of primitive, like sort of caveman-esque fear, but I think... We've all had childhoods, pretty much, of seeing the Warne and McGrath brutalising.
We have, but I think one of the reasons why Warne and McGrath and that attack was so good was that they actually complemented each other very well. That's not to say that
right, and he hasn't got
their own, and if you've got someone completely leaking runs at the other end, there's no pressure for the batsman to attack Warne. Secondly, I just think it's too much of a risk. So if Warne's brought back, it's the Australians admitting that they need to bring back a 41-year-old, which I think he now is, in order to defend the Ashes. If he's brought back and he takes one for 158,
Yeah.
In the Perth test, Peterson goes after him and smashes him all over, and Peterson plays Warne very, very well, and Peterson is looking anomalously good form. This is an Australian team in total annihilation if that happens, because they'll have played their last card and nothing will have come.
In a nutshell, this is whether his inspiration will be the issue or whether the sheer desperation of picking him will be the issue. Can you say he will walk into a dressing room, lift the entire side, and that will have an impact? Or will the Aussies simply be demoralised by the fact, God, we're so desperate, we need to drag this guy, who frankly was never in the greatest physical shape while he played. I can't imagine that playing poker's done great things for his career. But it's an interesting one. You'd have to say, if you're looking at this as a neutral, it would be fascinating
to
see.
Absolutely. It would be a great, great spectacle. And it would certainly, it would add a new dynamic to a series which certainly the press seem to have nailed as something that's
and also irritate, you would imagine, irritate the hell out of Nathan Horwitt, Steve Smith, and other Australian spinners, who are basically being told, we would rather drag this 41-year-old off a couch than play you.
And in fact, I think it would epitomise, one of the problems with the Australian team at the moment is it's showing the lack of development in players during the late 90s and early 2000s, when they had such a strong side that they didn't actually really develop any players to come through and fill their places. Warm back, it would just completely epitomise that
the
system,
one thing,
rather than going through the necessary period of pain when you have to bring in new players
and
you
slowly
have to, you have to slowly rebuild.
The interesting thing is that I think one thing this series has shown is the inability of the media, and I mean this is sort of stating the obvious, but to sort of remain slightly more level-headed about things. I think the Australians have had, if we're being frank about it, they've had, what is it now, you'd say they've had 5 days of very poor cricket, where they've struggled to take wickets with the ball, where they haven't made runs with the bat. But, I mean, this idea that the Ashes is now won and irretrievably gone, with 3 tests to go, I'm just not entirely sold on. I mean, I look at the Australian top order, you still feel that it's a top order full of ability. I mean, the bowling lineup, I would accept, it looks shocking as it stands, but it's still a batting lineup that could get an awful lot of runs.
It is, and I kind of feared, particularly after the first couple of days of the last match, I did fear a little bit of an Aussie backlash, and I thought, hey, these are some of the best batsmen. I mean, when you think of Ponting, he's one of the best batsmen ever to have played the game. He can easily come out and score 150 and put England in their place. But just the fact that it just has just failed to happen so much, and just everything about that team at the moment, not about the players when you look at them on paper over their careers, but about the team at the moment, just oozes mediocrity and just oozes a complete inability to take a game by the scruff of the neck.
And you do, I mean, what's very curious, I think, to me is how much can you turn around in, you know, a week, which is
exactly
what they've got. Like, in terms of the confidence, can they get that back? Can they turn around? Huge amount depends, obviously, which bowlers they go with. I mean, if they do bring Mitchell Johnson back, it does send some fairly bizarre messages out there in terms of selection policy.
In terms of selection policy, there's the question of how far you can regroup when actually so many players presumably just don't know whether they'll be playing in the next match, simply because the selection policy has been so chop and change. And actually, the Warne situation is the epitome of this. You know, it's this very short-termism that seems to be pervading what's going on.
Well, you could imagine the fuss in England if there was some sort of 41-year-old, 42-year-old who we were considering dragging out of retirement.
Phil Tufnell coming back.
Well, exactly. I mean, I would pay a vast amount. I mean, that would be the ultimate. Fifth test at Sydney, Tufnell v Warne. Let's move on. We talked too much about the Australians. Alistair Cook. We're going to talk about this is, if we've had Botham's Ashes, we've had Flintoff's Ashes, this is well on its way to being Cook's Ashes, which frankly, I would put my hand up and say, along with anyone else, I wanted to see the man dropped and see him nowhere near Australia before this series. He looked a liability, and so far he's been Bradman-esque.
He has, well, literally, he's been breaking Bradman's records, hasn't
he? Yeah, he's been breaking everyone's records. I mean, I haven't got the figure off. Well over 300 plus in between dismissals, and just a sort of sense of invincibility when at the crease.
It was minutes at the crease that were almost more impressive between dismissals. And he just seems, I mean, it's interesting how in this series, all of the people who have big question marks are over them as they came into the series. Could James Anderson bowl on Australian wickets, we asked. Could Mike Hussey make any runs, we asked. Yes, Mike Hussey's made runs. Yes, James Anderson can bowl on Australian wickets. And it's just this, I mean,
should we have, like, the only thing with Cook is, should we have known better? Because what I find interesting is, at what point with a player, because I think Cook had so many second chances that I'd got to the point with him, I felt, you honestly need to say, you're struggling, we bring someone new in, we give you a go. We give them a go. With Cook, the English selectors stuck to him out of what seemed to me at the time almost sort of a religious attachment. Mm-hmm. He is our next captain, we'll keep him. But, you know, were there any, I mean, did you, was there anything, were there clues, you know, was there stuff that we should have seen then that would have led to this now? Or is this true out of the blue?
Without wanting to sound like a soothsayer, I did once see him in a school match when he was about 18 and thought he was a bloody good batsman, but then again, I was about 15 at the time, and he would have done.
He had the look of Bradman, did
he? He did. I recognise that.
His focus. I should get the feeling with him. His focus is clearly something a little bit special.
And
his ability
actually,
just
there,
to go
there
on.
There is something about sticking with a player that does give them that kind of focus. There is something about the kind of sort of hardening that having played through thick and thin and actually having played through your own failures.
Well, we've just talked about how the Aussie selection policy has a feel at the moment of desperate lucky dip to it. Whereas the England selectors, because I remember, it's not that long ago, where, you know, the England selectors were derided beyond belief. You know, this every decision seemed to be cack-handed and sort of poorly managed. At the moment, I almost can't remember the last time they got a big call wrong. I mean, they're getting all the big decisions right. They appear, we'll see who comes in for the injured broad, but they appear to have got this squad picked to perfection. Let us leave the Ashes behind, difficult though that is, and talk about, well, we're going to give the shortest ever review of the West Indies' ill-fated trip to Sri Lanka. I mean, I hope...
because there's only the patter of rain to...
Well, I mean, I hope the changing rooms were well-equipped, and I hope there was a good opportunity maybe for some team bonding.
Which the West Indies needed, like...
Yeah, well, I'm sure they... I mean,
they probably appreciate it.
It'd be a fascinating question. What did they do? What did the West Indies side do? For some reason, I'm not so interested.
I can't imagine that Chris Gayle was leading the party game.
You see, I'm not interested in the Sri Lankan side. I imagine they were very sensible, and you know, I can imagine Kumar Sangakkara sitting there reading the paper, but what Chris Gayle he does on a day off is more... Anyway, the key thing here is that very little happened. Sadly, a series that could have been quite interesting wasn't. The new cricket journalism cliche appears to be that Darren Bravo looks like Brian Lara. He does a bit. The main thing is that suddenly the West Indies have a fair few young cricketers who you can get excited about. And I can see Toby literally rocking on the sofa in excitement about them.
About these young West Indian cricketers. Well, yeah, as we know from previous episodes of this, I have a bad feeling about the development of West Indies.
My relationship with the West Indies is sort of like with an orphan who refuses to accept that sort of daddy has died, basically. I won't let this West Indies squad go.
It's a personal way to have looked at it.
That's how I feel about the West Indies.
The West Indies far than your cricketing ability. Yeah. Well, having seen you bowl off spin,
I'm very much a son of
Suleiman Ben
Garfield Sobers. Anyway, moving swiftly on, South Africa India. Quick preview on this series. Battle between the two wannabe number ones, both coming out of shocking. Shocking might be too harsh. South Africa.
But less than convincing series.
Yeah, South Africa struggled to a draw against the Pakistan side in a mess. India, well, I mean, not convincing winners against New Zealand. You feel actually this has the potential to be a really good series. The question to me seems, can India's batsmen prove themselves in foreign conditions? South African pitches, when England were there last year, were exciting, were lively. Well, not all of them, some of them.
And it's going to be interesting because it's the... I think almost undoubtedly the best seam attack in the world against
it is
the best batting lineup in the world.
I would say I think when Steyn and Morkel fire, they are a really effective combo. They do a very different thing, and I mean my feeling about it, I wonder if it won't be where India come a little bit unstuck and where a lot of this sort of vibe around the team as world number one starts to look maybe a little bit premature. Good test for some of their young cricketers as well. But it could certainly be a very interesting series. Can we have a Toby Chadd prediction?
Of that series? Well, I think India usually do pretty well in South Africa historically. I say that off the top of my head with an inkling, and I may be completely wrong.
But I have
a feeling that they do. And it's a four-test series, am I right?
Four-test series.
I think we might be looking at... I think that there are going to be results, and I think it might be 2-1 South Africa.
Okay.
What are you thinking?
Yeah, no, I'm thinking South Africa. I'm thinking... It will. I think what we're going to have at the end of the day is we're going to find ourselves in exactly the same position we were before, in that we have two sides, both very good, but neither really great.
Neither
looking
able
great.
To completely
and no one will pay any
authority.
Attention because they're watching the Ashes, yeah. Which is unfortunate because it'll be a very. I think it'll be a very good series.
And talking of the Ashes, should we
move swiftly on?
Toby
is going to take us. From the archive section, and Toby's been delving in slightly the more recent archives this week.
After matches from, I think, 1929 and 1959, we're now coming up to 1998, which gets a bit scarily modern for me. I feel slightly out of my depth. So the Ashes series in Australia, 98-9, the first test is tied. Australia have the upper hand. A storm comes in and saves England, but it's not entirely one-sided. England, I think, is six down at the close, tasting something they're never going to get. But you can call it a creditable draw, if not a convincing one.
Not looking too horrendous yet.
It's not looking too horrendous. Second test is at Perth. These are, and I'm sure we're gonna debate this, but I think these are two pretty strong batting lineups between them. Just to quickly run through Australia: Taylor, Slater, Langer, the Waterans, Ponting, and Healy.
Now that's a
set of strong batting line. England: Butcher, Atherton, Hussain, Stewart, Ramprakash, Crawley, Hick.
You see, I'm very weirded out by Graham Hick going in at number seven.
Well, he was recalled specially for this match, and in quite interesting circumstances, because he always had a reputation of never being particularly good against the quicks, and as we'll see, the quicks have quite a big part in this.
It's an England batting lineup that, if you compare to today, well, I wouldn't say it inspires the same confidence. But let's.
No, it doesn't. Maybe I'm hanging on to the kind of wishfulness of my youth, hoping that these men are going to be able to go out and do something. Anyway, let's move on to the
tell the story.
On to the match. So, Gillespie is picked for Australia ahead of Stuart McGill, who's actually bowling very well at the time. Shane Warne is out at the time with a dicky shoulder that threatens to end his career. So Jason Gillespie's in for Australia, and England, in sort of fighting fire with fire, hand Alex Tudor his debut. Now that's a blast from the past, isn't it?
I will let you finish, but I would happily spend 3 hours talking about Alex Tudor. But let's
well, I'll give
on.
You half a minute. So as I say, the Perth pitch is a quick one, and there's literally bloodshed in England's innings, which lasts but 39 overs and 112 runs. Alex Stewart top scores with 28, and Glenn McGrath takes three wickets, and it's one of those classic encounters with Mike Atherton where Atherton just looks like a complete fish out of water, doesn't know what to do.
So when you say classic encounter, you sort of mean yet another ritual humiliation
exactly,
for an England opener.
Damien Fleming takes five in that innings as well. England bat for two sessions, make 112, outcome Australia, and they coast into the lead. They're 150 for three at the end of the day. But then the next morning, on the second morning, things swing dramatically the other way. Six wickets fall for 31 runs. And you sense that the Australian sort of that Australia have sort of caught the English bug for middle-order batting collapses. Tudor and Goss take seven between them. And Mark Waugh, probably one of the game's more fluent batsmen, scores 17 off 107 balls. So there's a little bit of parity restored. But then, towards the end of the second day, so we're kind of mid-afternoon on the second day and two innings are already out of the way. England go back in and manage to reach 67 for five at close of play. But then...
painful stuff.
Maybe withholding Hick to number seven is a good thing to do, because in he comes. You've got to remember, this is a man who never really quite makes it in Test cricket. I mean, he plays 50-odd tests, but he's always been successful as a...
Yeah,
as
a notorious nearly
as,
man.
As a one-dayer, a notorious nearly man. Who's always a bit suspect against half and half pace. Anyway, he comes out and he smashes the top score in the match, which is 68. Jason Gillespie describes himself as pogoed, by which I'm not entirely sure what he means, but anyway,
it sounds horrible.
It does sound humiliating.
Slightly sordid, yeah.
But that's after Hicks hit him for 16 in just three balls. Mark Ramprakash, another not quite Test player. Comes out and scores 47, but England only must 191 between them, and Australia knock off that deficit for the loss of just three wickets.
I mean, the first thing why I was delighted that you chose this one from the infinite archives was that anyone born under a certain age, born over, who does not remember, for whom this Ashes series is one of their first, needs to go through these scorecards and be aware that for those of us who at least
used to be.
Grew up through battering after battering, for whom this was it was something that would never change. This was how the natural order would be. You've got to read these scorecards to see what it was like. And it's why it's only so sweet now because of how horribly one-sided this was. But Alec Tudor, Alec Tudor, one of those players, one of those ultimate what-if players. Not a bad batsman, actually. Not a bad tail-end batsman at all.
No,
famous 99 against against New Zealanders.
Yep.
Very lively bowler, and one of those careers that just got away, went astray, and one of those really tragic what-ifs, I would say.
And he was still... I don't know off the top of my head, but he was still playing fairly recently.
Well, he's been playing at county level for a while with on and off limited success, injuries and stuff, and you just feel one of those careers that just never quite got going. But you also, in terms of comparisons to the present, that pitch, aside from anything else, this Ashes has been defined. I'm all for, I think, a good Test series. You have a couple of good batting tracks, but you need to have a couple of proper bowling tracks, a couple of real sort of nightmare batting tracks. And I doubt we'll see one here in Perth.
But what's quite interesting about this Test, and it was something that it shared in common with a lot of the Tests in the 2009 Ashes, is that there were sort of disastrous sessions where the match suddenly swung in the other direction, when six wickets fell for 30 runs and things like that. And there was a lot of that in 2009. And there hasn't been that much of it in this last... In the last two tests of this.
Well, it's been quite extraordinary at times. The sheer lack... I mean, England's batting, the sheer lack of wickets. I mean, you can't help thinking that... I mean, this, you would love to see a pitch, a really lively wicket. Like, you'd love to see both these batting lineups tested on something a little bit livelier. But you just can't see us... The way the game has gone, you just can't see us getting something like
and
that.
And you do wonder whether the Australian bowlers are going to manage to... take advantage of something like that. That's to be seen, and maybe we'll be made to eat our words.
Yeah, well, perhaps that would be the option. You gamble, you tell your groundsman to go out with a pickaxe and hack up the wicket.
Well, you think of the last test of the 2009 Ashes and the way that turned all over the place in the Australians.
That's sort of lively. Let's move on. Let's a couple of articles we've read this week that have been fairly interesting. I'll make a start. Christian Ryan, very famous. I'm overused to the word notorious. Famous Australian cricket writer, rather writing a pretty interesting blog at the moment on Cricket Info, My Funeral, Your Ashes. And it was an article, Waltzing Not Wiltzing, written on the penultimate day of the most recent test. And really, the talking point of this article and the interesting thing about it was he basically said, look, however bad things are, with the current Australian side, there is something about the Australian mentality that it will never get back. It will never be as bad as the England of the early 2000s or the England of the late 90s. And sort of the issue this raised for me is, are we dealing with sort of an Australian arrogance here that simply they're unwilling to face that actually that could happen? Or, I mean, is he on to something? I mean, is there something about this Australian style? Is there, are we going to see, is there a resilience that means even when the ability's not here, they just keep fighting in a way that England, frankly, you know, fight is not a word that you could use about the England of the late 90s, really.
No, it's not. And I think it depends whether you're talking about this team or about Australian cricket in general, as it were. I think with this Australian team at the moment, frankly, we've seen that they do have a bit of an inability to be able to fight and go out and bat. I mean, when you think day five of the last test, the way that they capitulated surrounding, there is something. There is something hugely English about that.
Yeah.
The way that you get in a vaguely dangerous situation, but it's savable. I think
any reasonable English fan expected a fight that day. No one expected it to be done.
I made the mistake of going to bed early and getting up at 5 o'clock the next morning because I just knew that
hard-fought Hussey
would still be there. It's over in an hour and a half.
No, and you expected that. And I think that says something about how we've still got this inferiority complex regarding how we view the Australians. But maybe, I mean, are we going to see the fight come back? Because it's seen as such an important part of their culture, but so far, not a huge amount of offer.
Mm. And I think in the longer term, Australia do have this huge problem that they maintained such a stable side and such a good side for so long that they actually failed to blood. And yes, you had players who had played 600 matches at first class level or whatever, and scored tens of thousands of runs at first class level, but had never played in the Test arena. And what they're doing now is they're actually starting from quite, in terms of the Test experience of some of the players, they're starting at quite a low quotient, particularly when people like Hussey and Ponting retire, which is in the far distant future.
I mean, the one thing I found slightly fascinating, just to finish on this, is that the English journalist's traditional occupation has been England are down, kick the crap out of them, basically. Whereas the Australian, you know, it was something quite touching in seeing Australian journalists, you know, a lot of them have been doing that, but to see an Australian journalist almost rush to the defence of the side and say, look, we're struggling, but it's never going to get that bad. What have you been reading?
I've got rather a more balanced, perhaps, article by Andy Bull on the Guardian's The Spin section, in which he talks about the strange situation with Ricky Ponting at the moment. He is the most successful player in the history of cricket, statistically. He's won more matches than anyone else. He'd won more as captain as well. He's won 47 so far, and then the next he's won I think. Hang on, 2 seconds. So he's won 98 matches as a player. The next highest is Mark Boucher, who's still 29 off, and I think that says quite a lot.
So that is an extraordinary.
You've got a great batsman. You've got a hugely successful captain, a hugely successful player, but you've got someone who is about, probably, I'm completely cursed it by saying that, but is about to become only the third ever Australian captain to lose three Ashes series. And that is just this horrible dichotomy.
It gets talked about, I guess, a little bit more in politics than it does in sport, but there's always this idea of a legacy.
Yeah.
And you can't help feeling that if Ponting goes out on another Ashes, I never thought of it like that, but the idea that you are actually dealing with no player has won more Test matches than him, you know, extraordinary.
But yet, and he what could a go player, out under a
but
cloud.
He might be, yep. Well, he might genuinely be remembered as a loser, you know, to lose the Ashes to England three times is astonishing, but you can't help feeling that there is a genuine injustice almost will have been done there for a player who is very much great. Is that your feeling, is that he's very much a guy on the way out? Are we going to see him any big fight back innings in this series? We'll see him make.
I think he's a class batsman, and I think you can never discount him. I do though think that when you compare him to someone like Tendulkar, who's of a similar age and is still going, the difference between them is that Tendulkar seems to kind of play with a carefreeness that Ricky doesn't have, because he is responsible for this side. If he loses, if he was just a batsman and he lost, it would be nowhere near as big as his being the captain and losing.
Yeah, I agree. I come back to this idea. I genuinely think, I imagine him going into that dressing room, looking around and just thinking, dear God, you know, he has to work with, you know, if you criticise him for losing the series, in both now, both 2009 and 2005, he's been limited by the players he's had. I mean, I think 2005, he still had a very strong squad, but he has very much been limited by the players he's had. Let us conclude with the debate.
A brief note on the only the other thing that's been rivaling the Ashes in the sporting headlines recently.
The real culture, the key issue at the moment has been moaning about FIFA's inability to award the Football World Cup to England. And the topic we were thinking of the week was that FIFA have clearly shown a desire to promote football through giving their World Cup to minor nations, sort of small footballing nations. And, I mean, even when we say that with a country like Russia, it's a country that's not well established. You know, football hasn't maybe dominated there or hasn't been as big there, and certainly with Qatar. And the issue is, could cricket use their World Cup in a similar way? The much, much maligned Cricket World Cup, could it be used in a similar way?
I think you would. The number of nations playing football to a... Well, I mean, simply the number of people following football in different nations makes it a completely different proposition to cricket. The fact that, you know, there's an Andorran football team that, you know...
You say nothing of the Andorran cricket side.
I've heard of, and I know nothing about football. Even though I don't know who the England captain is at the moment. Well, I probably do, but... And I think the problem with adopting a similarly evangelical approach to...
spreading the word.
To cricket is that A, who on earth would turn up and watch it if you played it in Afghanistan?
My personal favourite would be hosting in Afghanistan. Okay, they have been extremely successful. They've developed at a speed that no other associate ICC member has for a while. I do take all your points. My one feeling is that I do think occasionally cricket is very complacent. I mean, in a way, it's one of the charms of the game that we're this small, closely knit family. But you think there are these countries out there that are keen on the game, but through lack of support from the ICC, through lack of a clear development strategy.
Yeah, but that's what it is. I think what you're trying to do is go in at the top level by giving someone a World Cup. And actually, that would mask the fact that the ICC is absolutely awful at fostering cricket on a small scale, on a local scale, in a lot of the smaller countries. I'm thinking sort of Kenya and
Kenya is a great example of a country that had promise and appears to have gone hugely backwards. I mean, you've got all these countries, sort of, you know, Holland, Canada, the US, Scotland, even. I mean, Ireland have had some success, who seem to have been stuck, who don't appear to have moved forward anywhere for such a long time. I mean, Afghanistan is this wonderful success story where, given, you know, pretty much the most obvious impediments that any sport progress being made, they've had incredible success. But you just wonder that it would be very interesting to see the World Cup used in a more creative way, perhaps maybe even co-hosting with
frankly, anything's going to be better than the West Indies World Cup a few years ago.
I mean, that became an endurance thing, didn't it? Trying to actually follow that.
Well, in 2011, it's going to Sri Lanka, India, and
Bangladesh. So we're sort of there,
but then 2015 off to Australia and New Zealand. So back to the old stomping.
Very much the old guard.
It won't be for some time if it does.
Yeah,
happen.
We're sticking very much to the old cricketing family. Well, that has been episode 4 of Reverse Sweat Radio. Thank you very much for listening. And we will be back in 2 weeks' time to talk of, well...
So I think 2 weeks' time is Christmas Day or something, isn't it?
We'll be back literally talking on Christmas Day about...
Looking forward to the Boxing Day test.
Well, hopefully reminiscing on yet another innings triumph and talking about how Shane Warne's comeback went tragically wrong and these sort of things.
And proving ourselves right in everything we said.
But, yeah, thank you very much for putting up with 33 and a half minutes of us.